You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence is brought to you today from the stolen lands of the Wadawurrung people of the Kulin Nations. I acknowledge sovereignty was never ceded. I acknowledge elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respects to any First Nation listeners tuning in today. This show supports First Nations people in their struggle for self-determination, land back, sovereignty, restitution, and treaty.
Slums in some metropolitan centers are coming down, condemned by forward-looking civic governments. Down are coming the bad living conditions that produce bad citizens.
The practical uses of asbestos are very numerous. At least 18,000 articles are made of it.
In the spring, the nature-loving Australian goes bush.
The wife washes and the dishes dry themselves.
Amy is a serial pest.
Cities within cities, scientifically planned and built, where a man and his family with a small income can live with comfort and dignity as investments in democracy.
Out of the rubbish tip and straight to your ears is me, Amy, for a podcast edition of Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence. The show went to air on the 17th of April. However, I was 15 minutes late to the show as a friend of mine that morning was sick and I was just helping them out. So that happens. That's the way life goes. And I am re-recording some parts of this episode so that you get to hear everything that I had planned. On today's show, we're going to begin with Urban Wasteland Survival Guide and cool stuff that we don't use, but probably should. Finishing up our topic last week of water survival and water saving. And then we're going to hear the feature interview of this week's episode, which is my interview with Dr. Alex Knight on frogs, urban impacts on frogs, and what we can do to help protect them. But now, let's begin with Urban Wasteland Survival Guide. Welcome to part two of Urban Wasteland Survival Guide, Water Survival Edition. Last episode, I talked about my handy-dandy olive barrels and how I use them to collect rainwater and other water. Now we're going to pick up right where I left off. So we're talking about ways that you can save water at home, some health concerns and risks around it, and how it might help you build a bit of water resilience. So if one day, for some reason, you can no longer get water from your tap and you have to collect your own, you know a little something about collecting water, storing it, and where to go to learn how to do more. Now, if there is an emergency situation where you are storing water for purification and drinking, then I recommend getting yourself an off-grid living or prepper book. You can download a whole bunch of them off Anna's archive. Water being stored for drinking purposes goes flat, even becomes unsafe, can be stored incorrectly or in the sun. This means your water storage system will require a degree of ongoing maintenance to ensure it is safe to drink. So, unlike my 220-liter olive barrels, you may want to consider, for storing drinking water, smaller containers because the maintenance requires moving the water between vessels. So 20 liters is a pretty good and manageable size for most people, but you may want to go even smaller if you struggle to lift around 20 kilograms. This is just to give you an idea of how difficult and labor-intensive it can be to maintain your own drinking water. We are very lucky we have access to reliable and clean water sourced straight from our taps, but it does mean we are less educated on how to access water if the system fails. And much like the enclosure of the commons, where common land was a place where people could just grow food and they didn't have to worry about who owned it, landlords and stuff like that, colonization of this continent has destroyed natural drinking water sources, fresh streams and the like. So if an emergency situation does arise, most of us will have to find ways of collecting it in urban environments and off our roofs. Okay, so what are some ways that you can collect and save water now? Well, if you're washing grains or vegetables, boiling pasta or noodles, why not place a bucket in your sink to transport the water outside? This water can be transferred into a watering can for even an effective watering, or into the aforementioned storage container for later use. You can throw boiling hot water on weeds you or your landlord once did. Don't throw it on plants you like though, especially if there is salt in that water, as it can make your plants sick and they can't handle salt unless they are a coastal plant that has evolved to cope with salt water. So make sure you're careful where you throw it. Now what about water from your washing machine, dishwasher, or even sink, also known as grey water? Don't forget to listen back to the previous episode where I talk a little bit more about the dangers of grey water and septic water. And a reminder, never handle septic water. And if you do handle grey water, to do it with the utmost care, and probably it is advisable to wear something to cover your mouth and eyes, as it can make you extremely sick, and it is definitely not safe for drinking. Well, the legendary zine collection, Making Stuff and Doing Things, has a zine called The Politics of Piss, Basic Grey Water. The zine says you can unscrew that white plastic pipe underneath your sink so the water doesn't go down the drain and out the house, but instead down the drain and into a bucket you place under the sink. So this grey water then could be used from the kitchen elsewhere, like in your garden, or as they cleverly suggest, poured into your toilet bowl to flush the toilet. Your toilet's flush is just water pouring from the tank to the bowl and gravity doing the rest to take the waste away. So the bucket filled with water is just replacing what the tank already does. However, this water from sinks will likely contain fecal matter, meat, animal products, all kinds of bacteria that can go septic and make you seriously sick and ill. So I actually advise against their method. I included it today because I wanted to show an example that you might see out there. Well, however, if you do have a bucket of water from those grains you just washed, maybe that could be used in your toilet bowl. And definitely never store water that you might think is septic. Get rid of it immediately. Pour it down the drain or onto your garden. And again, try not to splash any of it on you or into your mouth and eyes. And if it ever does happen, immediately shower and consider seeking medical help. I once made the mistake of emptying the washing machine water into one of my olive barrels and letting it sit there. I thought, washing machine water shouldn't be too dirty, it's grey water, surely it'll be fine. I was wrong. The most foul smell emanated from it within a day, and it was definitely very unsafe. What I do with my washing machine water is when I'm running a cycle, washing my clothes through, I have the hose empty into a small bucket. I then take that bucket outside and throw it on some parts of my garden. That's a great way to use grey water if you don't have a grey water system with your washing machine. Again, avoiding contact with mouth and eyes and immediately getting rid of it. Don't let it sit. Going back to the zine, it also advocates pissing outside and in the shower. I will say that again, your urine could contain both useful and harmful things. Hardcore composters will tell you that urea found in urine is fantastic at breaking down brown leaves. But what goes in goes out, and with bodies, what goes in gets processed, chemically changed, and then comes out. So again, consider hygiene whenever you read or hear this kind of advice. The medication you're taking, for example, may leave something residual in your waste. Also, don't forget the wise old saying, if it's yellow, let it mellow. If it's brown, flush it down. Do you need to flush every time you wee? Now let's go back to emergency water. Rainwater or freshwater streams are considered the best for collecting water before you purify them, of course. You can also tap certain trees for water. You can also wrap a plastic bag around certain trees' leaves on a hot day to extract evaporated water from them and dig for water. All you need is the right equipment and know-how, so why don't you get yourself one of those disaster preparedness books? Keep it and hope you never have to use it. And don't forget your neighbours. Get your local library to order that book in too. In an emergency situation, your odds of survival increase working and sharing with others, not living in a hole in the ground. Maybe you're the one who brings the water know-how and your neighbour brings another skill. So lastly, you want to know a bit about filtering and purifying water. Well, all right, here you go. Go to a workshop where someone teaches you how. Whether it's chlorine tablets, biofilters, charcoal, or whatever you want to do, you should learn firsthand from someone who knows what they're doing and has tried them before. Not every water filtration system you read out there online or purification system you read out there will be enough to filter the water for every potential source that you get it from. Remember, if you have rainwater going off your roof, it might contain the heavy metal chromium, potentially a biofilter, which is water passing through sand that has had a good bacteria added to it to eat away bad bacteria, will not likely deal with heavy metals. So if you try a biofilter on your rusting roof, you're probably not going to get the chromium out. So you can appreciate here the depth of knowledge required to have usable, drinkable water for survival. Anyway, that's it for Urban Wasteland Survival Guide this week, but stay tuned for the return of cool stuff we don't use, but probably should. Thank you.
You're listening to 3CR, an apartheid-free zone. 3CR's Committee of Management has passed a declaration formalising our commitment to a free Palestine. As an apartheid-free zone, we're committed to boycotting Israel's regime of oppression. We stand firmly against apartheid in Palestine and encourage other organisations to join us in this struggle. Visit our website to read the full declaration and learn more about our commitment to justice and liberation for Palestine and the apartheid-free zone movement.
Welcome back. You're listening to Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence, and this is cool stuff that we don't use, but probably should. Well, this week, to complement water survival skills and water saving, we're going to talk about rainwater and greywater tanks and composting toilets. Water systems have formed on this planet where the rain lands. Under your feet, beneath the soil and rocks, is groundwater. We take groundwater out of the ground quicker than it naturally recharges. One of our reasons for this is our drainage systems. Rainwater is collected over the suburbs as what's called stormwater, and then rushes towards a river that did not use to get this massive rush before modern drainage. The water where our suburbs are now went down into the ground and into many lakes, streams, and creeks that no longer exist and now have a house. Remember that UN report from the last episode? Well, our depletion of groundwater is contributing to massive sinkholes emerging right across this planet. So one way we can look after rivers and the complex systems under our feet is to have water landing on our roofs and flowing into our gardens. If every house had a rainwater tank, we would be saving water for household and garden use, relieving rivers and lakes of stormwater, and a source of usable water for disaster. It would economically save us money from our personal finances, reducing the impact of disasters, and relieve our water infrastructure from being a single centralized source for all our water needs. Why stop at rainwater tanks, however? How about we also make sure that every house has a greywater system? According to the Victorian EPA, untreated greywater, which does not include water from the kitchen or toilet, can be safely used in your garden or washing machine. And our public water companies are investing and building water treatment plants which send usable greywater to our homes. However, this is mostly in new housing developments and has not been rolled out across most suburbs. If you have a greywater system, all you need is greywater safe cleaning products so that you can safely use your stored greywater on your garden. In fact, approximately 40% of total water use in Australian houses could become greywater. Only 26% of Australian households currently have rainwater tanks. Renters make up a third of the housing market and have no autonomy whether or not to install rainwater tanks. It's up to their landlords, who obviously are disinclined to do it as it is seen as an unnecessary cost. And of course, we have many homeowners struggling with their mortgages. And if we look at the new housing developments, there isn't much outdoor space for newer housing builds. The days of a quarter acre block where it was 60 house, 40 garden, 60 garden, 40% house are long gone. And now we seem to have 90% house, 10% garden, even 95% house, 5% garden. So we are clearly struggling to get the most amount of water savings out of the current property market. And there's one more thing, septic water. goes to a water treatment plant from our homes. But did you ever hear of composting toilets? You can buy composting toilets, which come with a whole kit and a way to compost your waste. There are people who have built systems. Instead of the waste going into plumbing, it goes underneath their garden and empties out into the soil deep underneath the garden where it's safe, but also continues to feed the garden above. I'll include a video in today's show notes to an amazing Swedish man who has done the most innovative composting toilet in his home and is reaping an incredible amount of food just from the simple system that he devised. So while currently we don't use this cool stuff as much as we could be, it seems to be for the privileged few who have autonomy and can afford it, we can still fight to increase these things. We can still fight to educate others about these alternatives and push for ways for them to become more accessible. We can make stronger guidelines, regulations, and reforms for building new properties, for example. Most councils, cities have a sustainability group. If you're really interested in challenging property developers in your area and trying to push your local council or state government into reforming its regulations around property development, maybe even pushing landlords into installing some of these things, then join your local sustainability group. There are heaps of them out there. You can also join revolutionary organizations which push for a massive systemic change in these areas, like the Renters and Housing Union. You can be part of the momentum of bringing this cool stuff into our everyday lives.
Friday, May 1st is May Day, International Workers' Day. Join 3CR all day in our 50th year of coverage, in solidarity with the continued struggle for labour rights and fair working conditions for all our communities around the world.
We got May Day specials from regular Friday shows and special presentations from 3CR's programmers from across the grid. For more info, head to www.3cr.org.au/May Day 2026.
Friday, May the 1st.
Tune in all day right here on 3CR.
What if one meal could change someone's life? Host a feast for freedom this autumn at your home, workplace, or in your community and cook delicious recipes shared by our hero cooks from Palestine and Sri Lanka. Bring people together over food and raise vital funds to support people seeking asylum. Register now and host your feast by the 30th of April at feastforfreedom.org.au. Feast for Freedom is an initiative of the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre, a 3CR supporter.
Welcome back. We are now going to move into our last segment and feature interview for today, which is talking to Dr. Alex Knight about frogs, their importance to our ecosystems, and the impacts of urban development on their lives.
Hi, Amy. My name is Alex. My full name is Dr. Alexandra Knight. I have a PhD in frog ecology and also environmental sociology, and I live in Northeast Victoria, and I'm really committed to advocacy for frogs and also everything biodiversity, because I think Australian nature is amazing and it's in a state of decline, and I'm keen to see that trend stabilised and reversed.
There seems to be like an invisibilization for insects and small critters here, like we tend to focus on the koalas or gliders, something like that that's a bit bigger. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, Amy. And one of the things when I was starting my research into frogs, which I came to later in life, was that I focused in on a small and little known frog called Sloane's froglet. And at that time, it was all but forgotten. And I actually spoke to on ABC radio there and about Sloane's froglet. And then I sent a picture in and the response was, oh, it's really tiny and grey. I was like, yes, it's time for the really tiny things to get their voice. And it's not just like a small frog, but its voice wasn't heard at all. And I think that's really true. I think there's lots of people in the community now who are more interested in the small things. Like, I've got a fab friend, Karen Retra, who is like the voice of invertebrates. She knows everything about native bees. And so I think there's more people that are sticking up for the small and little known things. But I still think it's hard when something is really hard to see or hear and it's not cute and it's not fluffy and you can't have your photograph with it, you can't do a selfie with it. It's quite hard to get funding for those things. And it's also actually quite hard as a scientist to research them and find out about them. And sometimes you really need specialized approaches to that. So I think you're spot on. The good thing about, you know, the gorgeous and fluffy is that sometimes they can act as a, I guess, an umbrella for those smaller things. But that doesn't always work, you know, because Australian nature is like so amazing and our creatures are so diverse and they all have their own little niches and habitats and things that they specifically need. So sometimes it works, and having, you know, the koala up there in the news can help other species as well, but sometimes it doesn't. So it's a tricky thing. One of the things that we tend to forget about is connection, and connection is so important for everything, for the way the world works, for the way that people work, and for the way that plants and animals and fungi and bacteria and all the little unseen things work together. And I think you're really right there, and classic examples of that is the way that fungi has been treated, and we've just looked at like the mushroom without understanding what's happening underneath the earth. And then, you know, more recently we've discovered things like how important it is to have fungi in rehabilitation and restoration of areas and how that helps plants grow. So it's all interconnected. It's so fundamental, isn't it? And once again, it tends to be a problem as a scientist, because as you go further and further into research, you tend to focus in on one thing and your vision can get smaller and smaller. But actually, the questions that we're facing as society are kind of bigger and bigger questions about landscape connectivity and where humans fit in that space and how we can really promote the more than human world and look after ourselves by looking after the more than human world. So, yeah, it's a big question.
You must also be like a bit of a pioneer in some ways, because I was interviewing residents and farmers in Glen Allerdale near Bairnsdale about a mine being built on the Mitchell River. And one of the farmers has left a huge amount of like indigenous landscape, including sacred trees and stuff, just on his property untouched. But near it, he grazes these cows, and the residents and farmers had to do their own environmental effects statement because the mining company did a bogus one, and just didn't even look for all the animals that were already there. They just said, oh, it won't be here, so we won't look for it. And they also did it remotely from Tasmania. So it was a very good, thorough environmental assessment by the mining company there. Anyway, I don't remember which frog it was. It might have been the growling grass frog, but it was a frog that people don't understand a lot about, and they're not sure how it survives. So perhaps that's ringing bells for you, perhaps not. But he was grazing cattle in the area that they found the frog, and then he said to the person that helped identify the frog, oh, should I get these cattle away from this frog? And because it might kill them, or, you know, might be affecting it. And then the expert said, no, We don't know how this frog is surviving, so it could be some weird way that your frog is surviving through the cattle, because apparently in the Merri Creek in the city, this frog was on the Merri Creek, and then they cleaned up, they did this big cleanup of pollution and stuff, and then the frog disappeared after they did the cleanup. So they must, so the person was a bit like, oh, just be mindful of it, but just, we don't know. So I guess that shows that there's still an understanding to be around these creatures, because they're so not considered important, and there must be so many things we still got to understand about them.
I think that's really true, Amy, and I'm not surprised by your story, unfortunately. There's a couple of things in what you say. It sounds like it might have been the growling grass frog or southern bell frog, but I'm not sure in this case. I'm not aware of the specific case. But there's so much that we don't know about frogs. And yet, at the same time, everything we do know about them shows just how amazing they are, and also that they're like full of advice for human beings. I just think that, because it's like, you know, they have opportunities to, or we have opportunities to understand more about water quality, water quantity, water temperature, soil health, connectivity of habitat. All those things influence how frogs survive in our environment, and we know very little about that. You know, there's some really good people who've done lots of work, but it's just like the tip of the iceberg, and there's so much more. And I think in particular with the growling grass frog or southern bell frog, I know that you have those around Geelong and the Bellarine Peninsula, and they're a really important frog, and they're an amazing frog. They're huge in frog terms, like, you know, 10 centimetres, bright colours, and they were really common across southeast Australia, and now they've all but disappeared. And in places like Gippsland, there's only very small remnant populations, but you do have them around Geelong. And, like, they're a beautiful frog, and there's some scientists like one of my colleagues, Jeff Hurd, who's done, like, several years of research into that species and found out, you know, more about their habitat requirements. But we still don't definitively know why they have declined. It could be because of chytrid fungus, which is this terrible fungus that frogs have been dealing with, you know, at least since the 90s or 1980s, and it has caused a decline of frogs worldwide. But there's just so much we don't know, and I think it's really important to take that cautious approach that the expert gave in the example you mentioned, because you could just change something and then that's it, you know. It's really important to be careful. The other thing that came to mind when you were telling that story to me is how important citizen science is and how important it is for communities to get together and input their own records into databases like iNaturalist or the Frog ID project with the Australian Museum, because it's often the case that developments proceed on a very short timeline, and what happens is a consultant has to go out and ascertain whether something is there, and they do it like they've got 2 weeks to do that in, and they might listen for frogs for 3 nights, and it might be the time of year when that frog isn't particularly active, or it just might have been a really dry spell and it's actually reduced its the area that it lives in, so it's not there at that time. And they just get missed all the time in those kinds of surveys. And the only kind of way around that is if community people, local people, people who know the area, frog enthusiasts, people who love frogs, get out there and start making records and putting those in databases that then have to be used in decision making. Because once the decisions are made and the wetland is filled in and the houses or the industries are built, it's too late. You know, it's really hard to get new information that comes to light after the development proposal has been approved, to get that considered at all.
Yeah, I feel like there's two questions I have from that. But the first one is that I remember our mutual friend said that you did a very interesting PhD in terms of working with community. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that and what was different about your approach in the PhD that maybe is different to what is usually done.
That's a really good question, Amy. Thank you. So I came to my PhD, like I started it at 45. So I'd already had a bit of a career and I had some ideas in mind about how it should be done. And I took an approach which I called intentional ecology. And that included four aspects. One was that I wasn't just going to research, I was going to advocate and act for my frog. And really, when I started, I didn't know how much trouble Sloan's froglet was in. And it turned out that it was in a fair bit of trouble and there was a lot of development going on in the really shallow wetlands that it likes to inhabit. Another kind of aspect of my research is I really wanted to show my care for the natural world or the more than human world, not just the natural and cultural world. So that world that, you know, it's all too easy to dismiss or think, oh, frog's not important, this wetland's not important. And also as a scientist, you're meant to be objective and take a step back from things like care or passion and just like do the science. But actually those things aren't mutually exclusive. You can really feel a really strong empathy for a frog and at the same time do really, really good science. You know, they're not mutually exclusive things. So there was also in my approach, I wanted to be really explicit about what I could and couldn't do. And one thing that is interesting about frogs is that most of the time we find frogs by their call rather than by seeing them. So I became really sensitive to noises, but also that means that I was pretty well always studying male frogs because they're the ones that do the calling. And I was like, well, where is the other? Where's the rest of the population and what are they doing? And a lot of the time when you read information about frogs, you don't just assume that it's all about the males, but it actually is. So it's a kind of quite subtle thing, but I don't know that it's thought of very much. And it could not be that subtle at all. Like, what are the female frogs doing while the male frogs are all gathering together and going, you know, doing their thing? So being explicit about my boundaries. And then the last thing was really about taking multiple approaches. So I didn't just study the habitat of Sloan's froglet. I studied it at multiple scales, so at the micro scale, what they were doing within a meter of where they were sitting and what they were doing at the wetland scale. But also I really wanted to explore what was going to happen with the new knowledge that I uncovered. So that thing of multiple approaches. So I did a bit of sociological research as well, and that was very revealing, and that and the advocacy really intertwined because it was quite a hard path and it took a bit longer than a regular PhD because once you start talking to people, you discover that people and communities are really interested in frogs and they really love them and they can come together and work for their well-being, but it takes time. And at times that kind of care for frogs is in direct kind of contradiction with development interests. And so for quite a while, I felt like I was hitting my head against a brick wall doing that advocacy work. And it took probably 5 years before that started to turn around. And that was frustrating and it took some perseverance, but it also gave me more time to understand Sloan's froglet better during that period of time. So that was my PhD research, and I had a goal. I wanted to try and get it done by the time I was 50, and I managed to hand it in 6 days beforehand. So that was good. Then I could have a party without feeling guilty that I wasn't working on my PhD. So it was a good thing. And since then, the amazing thing is, like, for those years where I felt like, oh, I've got to talk about Sloan's Roglet because no one's listening and I have to talk more and I have to talk more. And then now it's like people know about it and they hear about it and heaps of people are doing their own actions for Sloan's Roglet that I have nothing to do with. And I think that's such a successful thing for that frog that so many people have taken on board actions for its conservation and protection. So, yeah, it was a really interesting time in my life, which was, I guess, driven really strongly by my care and my ethics.
Sometimes I've seen some good, like, environmental analysis done of sites before there's a big build, but that doesn't really determine whether or not a developer will pay attention to that analysis. So they might say, there's stuff here, well, we need to build a road here, so oh well, we're just going to, you know, move it or do nothing about it. And so I think one of the things that people maybe don't understand is that animals and plants and all living things have to have an ability to adapt to change, and often human impacts are too quick. Like you were talking about that fungus, I know that there is several varieties of what's called a cinnamon fungus that wipes out almost entire forests of trees. And basically it's a fungus from a different forest, a different group of trees that haven't had any contact with each other for, you know, thousands if not millions of years. So the trees have been given a totally new fungus to adapt to that is wiping them out because they don't have the usual big lengths of time to develop the immune response to that. And so when we human beings come to build houses or roads in areas or just disturb what's happening for creatures, we're not giving them a very good means of adaptation. Whereas I suppose the original carers, and to some degree still are, First Nations people, and like Burns, for example, they would be slow and they would be deliberate to let animals get away when they would do various burnings and things. So I think my first question of the two is, what are your sort of observations about our ability, like, sorry, about how we're not allowing animals to adapt? We're not really taking care of them when it comes to these builds. We're just sort of moving them on.
It's such a big question, Amy, and it's such an important question. I think, you know, one of the things we talk about in conservation is death by a thousand cuts, and it's just like, okay, we'll do this development here and that's only a few amount of frogs there. There might just be two frogs living there, so that doesn't matter, and then we'll do this development here and then that's another 10 frogs or five wetlands, and it goes on and on and on and on until the landscape is completely fragmented, it's disconnected, and not only just are frogs not able to adapt to that situation, they're not even able to live out their full lives in that situation. I think it's happening across the landscape and across Australia more and more. You know, it's such a beautiful, huge, open, spacious country full of diversity that's unique that we have here, and yet we seem content to manage it by putting up fences around little parts of the landscape and letting the native animals live in that while the humans run free and create havoc over a lot of the rest of the landscape. I mean, I know that that's not all that humans do and that we also do worthy things and live useful lives. But at the moment in Australia, the scales have tipped too far one way. So you're right. And things like disease and climate change in particular, it's really important for our species to have opportunities to move across the landscape because they can't just adapt in situ where they were. They need the opportunity to move and to change and to flow and to connect. One of the things that people often think about with frogs is that it's just the wetlands. They need the wetland. They need that pond there or that big lagoon there. But actually frogs only live part of their lives in the water. They live part of their lives on land too. They obviously need water because like tadpoles like swimming around in water. That's what they do. But frogs spend the other parts of their lives, the parts like in winter when it's too cold or summer when it's too hot, in trees, in grass, in rushes, which aren't wetlands. And then we've got a huge amount of frogs in Australia, which are incredible, which are burrowing frogs. And they can spend up to 70% of their life under the ground. And that isn't necessarily right next to a wetland. So if we like, you know, give ourselves brownie points, pat on the back, we've fenced off this wetland, we've revegetated it, we've created a new stormwater drain here that those frogs can now live in. But where are they going to go when they want to bury themselves in the ground and the ground is actually covered in a road and it's completely impervious? So if you're a eastern banjo frog or pobblebonk, which you have around Geelong, beautiful big frog, so amazing. And, you know, you spend a third or two-thirds of your life underground and you live for 20 or 30 years. That's like 10 or 15 years. My maths is terrible for a scientist, I got to say. You know, 10 years under the ground, how does that work if you've kind of destroyed opportunities for movement in the landscape and you've only focused on the wetland and not the rest of the landscape? And I think you're really right too about adapting to disease, like, and that is really important with amphibian chytrid fungus. And there's been a lot of work undertaken in the Snowy Mountains trying to get the southern corroboree frog to survive because it's been really severely impacted by that fungus. And the hope is that over generations it might adapt to it more and be able to survive with it. But, you know, it's a long game and it's a hard game when there's other pressures on the environment.
I've seen, as someone who's worked with plants, I've worked as a gardener for the past several years, and it's been mostly in cities and suburbs, and that has included sort of re-veg sites or working alongside re-veg sites. And I've seen beautiful, well-constructed little endemic wetland areas for frogs, which are then surrounded by a lawn that's mowed every like fortnight or every month. So it's like you can be a frog in this little wetland, but then we're going to ride this heavy mower around you like like a little perimeter. And then after the lawn is a road, you know, because it's in the middle of a suburb. I also have worked in Melbourne along Donnybrook Road, suburbs along there, and that's a road managed by Vic Roads, and it's also a very like heavily like rubbish area. So there's a few wetlands with some very lovely noisy pobblebonks there, but they're not as beautifully managed as where I live in Geelong. In Geelong, actually, they're quite well managed. The wetlands, little wetland features, I kind of see them more as museum pieces because it's almost like, oh, here's what used to be here. Here's a little patch of what used to be here. But
historical nature.
Yeah. but I've worked along Donnybrook Road and I've seen those little wetlands less cared for. I'm not sure. I think they fell into Hume City Council's jurisdiction, but they're filled with rubbish that's blown in from the road, polystyrene's everywhere, but you still hear these polar bonks bonking in there. But in, you know, it's just like, I also, when I was working there, watched the kangaroos that lived there slowly get kicked out because their grasslands were being built over by, you know, the suburbs. And the suburbs, you know, were like 95% plus of that land. And that's what's happened. Like, it's just the land gets moonscaped. It just gets completely flattened and bulldozed. And then everybody's got to move out, and then we might leave, as you're saying, like one or two little feature pieces or something. But they don't connect, as you say, to the grasslands. And I was just talking on Friday on the show, I was just talking to the Grassy Plains Network about this and how they now say there's 0.65% of the Grassy Plains left in Victoria. I assume that the grassy, the growling grass frog is one of those frogs that needs grass.
Yeah, I think what it really likes is like ponds with reeds and rushes around the edge, and it likes a variety of vegetation, and it likes slow moving water. But it's really interesting what you say, and I think there's a couple of things like that. You know, you might think, oh, it's just in Melbourne and around Melbourne that this is happening and we're having these kind of devastating developments, or the developments that are devastating for wildlife but maybe less devastating for people. But it's not. It's in regional Australia as well. Like around here, I've seen so many of the wetlands that I spent my PhD time in my gumboots are now housing estates. And you know, every opportunity for the froglet to survive there has really been restricted. And there's been some great work done by council to ensure that the stormwater drains and settlement ponds are constructed in a way that will benefit that frog, but the connection isn't there anymore. But on the flip side of that, and I don't know if you have it around Geelong, but there's the worldwide movement in gardening for wildlife. It's a global movement, and certainly here we've got a really strong, active group of people who are really totally into it and who are always trying to educate themselves and do stuff and also work with the people in the newer suburbs who have large houses on small blocks of land, and just like try and invite those people to understand how important it is to have a native tree or a flowering shrub for the birds in those areas that will provide connectivity that way. Frog connectivity is a little bit harder, I think, because it depends a lot on soil and gullies and moisture flow, and most of that is managed by council and they like hard curbs and gutters, and we all like bitumen roads to travel on. So I think that the frogs suffer in that way, but you still hear people saying, oh, I accidentally dug up a popple bonk in my vegetable garden this week. And, you know, it's so they're still there and they're trying their best to survive with it. So it's about working together as a community to give that opportunity to people. And I think that works as community. Like the kind of flip side of this is that people say to me all the time, I love frogs. And I'm like, great. And, you know, people are willing to come together and talk about frogs and learn about frogs and do something for them. And I have been so fortunate. I think in the last 10 years or so, I would have spoken, I don't know how many times now, to groups in Northeast Victoria, Southern New South Wales, Mid New South Wales, and they're all focused on frogs and they're all coming together to try and do something for them. And I think that is an amazing and awesome thing. And they've been really successful in their activities in trying to promote frog breeding habitat. And schools have done amazing projects with art and frogs around here, which is phenomenal. And so whole new generations of people are learning about frogs and how to care for them. And to me, that is like a wonderful thing when the human community and the more than human community can come together and work for nature and build things together.
Yeah, I think that's probably my last question for today is, how can people protect frogs? I feel like two things that I have to add is that I think that anyone who's lucky enough to own their own home or to have some kind of autonomy over their garden, definitely look into gardening for wildlife. Obviously, if you're a renter or if you live in there's still some things you can do if you live in the new developments, but it's obviously much harder when the house has about a meter of garden before it hits the fence, because those houses just take up so much space. But I do think that there are some, like, that there is something that people can do with their own garden spaces to try and help wildlife. I've seen that there have been some people who've been able to establish small ponds in their yards and things like that. So I do encourage people to look at gardenings for wildlife. You just, all you have to do is type your local council into your search engine and put garden for wildlife, and pretty much every council in Victoria has quite good information on things you can do, including landscaping options for your garden. But yeah, so how can people fight to defend frogs, people who love frogs? We mentioned community science. What, take it away.
Yeah, so there's lots of things that people can do to protect frogs, and I think it's working as a community that really works best. So being in contact with groups like Gardening for Wildlife is really important, but there also might be a local field naturalist group or another or a land care group, which is really helpful. And you're right, there's absolutely things you can do on the small scale or the scale of your own backyard, including creating frog breeding habitat. And that might be something that you're actually, if you're on a smaller block, you might want to talk to your neighbour about. And it might be something that you can work on together. Or it may be that there is like a creek running through your area that you can volunteer at to help with things like the rubbish that you talked about. So there's those kinds of opportunities. And once again, if you search online, you will find that there is plenty of information about building a frog bog or a frog pond in your own backyard. So that's really important. I think the citizen science or community science is really, really important, because we can't make good decisions unless we have the information. And it's got so much easier to be part of the process of providing that information, especially for frogs with the Australian Museum Frog ID app. It's an app you can put on your phone, and all you have to do is record a frog call and submit it, and the wonderful people working in the Australian Museum will send you a really nice email back saying, thanks for your fab frog call, it was this frog. And then it goes into that database. And we've learnt so much about Australian frogs through that database. It's amazing. And that information can then be applied in planning decisions. So I think that is phenomenally important. With the pace of change that we have in our society now, it's quite hard sometimes to kind of keep up and think, what can I do for nature? But every little thing that you do does make a difference, if you do it thoughtfully and with care. And so if that thing is as small as putting in a flowering shrub for a bird, then that's great. If you can put in a frog pond in your backyard, that's great. If you can be with a community group, that's great. And if you can help with a citizen science project, that's also great. They're all really positive things.
And I also suppose make it an election issue. The state election in Victoria is coming up. Contact your environmentally friendly local representatives or candidates and make it an issue. Even in your local area, you can start petitions to your local member, and it is one way to try and get change. I know that the Greens have done quite a bit of advocating to improve Victoria's environmental laws. So yeah, make it an election issue.
That's a really good point, Amy. And I think advocacy and lobbying are such important things, because you don't get any kind of policy change or any kind of change in funding direction unless you speak out and make sure that the issue is known. And so it's such an important thing to do. That's a really good point. And don't just talk to your environmentally friendly politician. Talk to have the hard conversations as well with the ones who are just going like, oh, frogs, there's heaps of frogs. Who cares about frogs? Let's just get on with the road development. That's the important thing, the jobs and the roads, you know, like talk to everyone. I guess my lessons from up here were like I really had to talk to everyone, to people, kinds of people that I'd never talked to in my life before, and come out of my box and my preconceptions and go, hello, these frogs are really important. They're now nationally endangered. Let's work for their benefit. I think that is really important. Be persistent, persevere, come together.
Okie dokie, that's it for Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence this week. You can listen to back to this show and past episodes via the 3CR website at 3cr.org/killyourlawn or on your favourite podcasting platform. You can write to me at kylkyf@proton.me or message me on Instagram at 3cr_kill_your_lawn. Also, listen back to the Black Block from this week. That's the 13th of April's episode at 3cr.org.au/killyourlawn to hear me chat with Uncle Robbie in the second hour of his show about the mine being built on his country that I covered last year on the Mitchell River and about trans rights. And just before you go, Radiothon is coming up in June, so start saving your money. Just $2 if everyone who listened to my show, via podcasting, the website, Spotify, or iTunes, donated $2, I would smash whatever target they're going to set me. And $2 is tax deductible. So until next time, keep killing lawns and building community power.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.